Radio New Zealand News with Hewitt Humphrey. David Longhi will meet Māori Affairs Minister Koru Wetari later today to discuss the minister's involvement in the Māori loans affair following more revelations yesterday. At a hurriedly called press conference last night, Mr. Longhi said he would discuss inconsistencies in Mr. Wetari's recall of events. Yesterday, Rotorua businessman Rocky Cribb said he'd met Mr. Wetari in late October and fully discussed the loan and its terms and passed on to him a letter from a Hawaiian businessman, Charles Heen. This has been supported by the Secretary of Māori Affairs, Tamati Reedy. However, all along, Mr. Wetari has maintained that the first he knew of the loan was in mid-November. Mr. Wetari has also made two explanations about a diary entry for late October referring to travel to Hawaii, first brought to light by opposition MP Winston Peters. Mr. Wetari first said he'd proposed to attend the inauguration of the new Hawaiian state governor, but later said he would have travelled to Hawaii to discuss business proposals on housing and hotel development between the Maori people and Hawaiian interests. A fire raged for several hours last night at the site of a plane crash near Wellington in which three men were killed. The twin-engine Piper Aztec crashed into a ridge on the Orongorongo station near Baring Head around midnight on a flight from Paraparaumu to Christchurch. An air accident inspector is going to the site this morning with a police team from Lower Hutt, and the three bodies will be taken to Wellington Hospital for a post-mortem examination. The identity of the men hasn't yet been confirmed. Police first heard about the accident when they received a report of what was thought to be a flare sighting. Wellington helicopter pilot Peter Button was called in and managed to locate the site of the crash in the early hours of the morning. A relative of the woman held by kidnappers near Hamilton this week says it'll take a while for her to cope emotionally. The woman was bound, gagged and blindfolded for 2 days before police found the campsite. But a spokesman says she's physically unharmed.
Physically quite okay, a few scratches on the legs after being walking through the swamp through the cutty grass and jandals or bare feet. And a couple of nights in the bush in a tent with a few mosquitoes. So physically quite okay, but it's going to be a while to untangle that because she's. They talked about international tourism and car bombs and this type of thing, and of course with a lot of time to think, she's still very concerned about that sort of thing.
And the relative says it'll take another couple of days talking before the woman will start to get over the ordeal. The government has created a new honour today as New Zealanders celebrate Waitangi Day. The new title is the Order of New Zealand, and the Prime Minister says the membership of the Order will be limited to 20 living people at any one time. Mr. Longhi says people eligible are those who have rendered outstanding service to the Crown and people in either civil or military capacity. He also says the new Order is a significant further step in the evolution of royal honours distinctive to this country. Five prominent New Zealanders have been honoured with a new title today. They're the Māori Queen, Dame Te Ata Irangi Kāhu, our High Commissioner to India, Sir Edmund Hillary, Federation of Labour Vice President Sonia Davies, former Labour Party leader Sir Arnold Nordmeyer, and the well-known educationalist and academic Dr. Clarence Beeby. Celebrations at Waitangi today to mark the 147th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi are expected to be low-key. The commemoration will begin at 9:30 this morning when the Governor-General, Sir Paul Reeves, and other VIPs are welcomed onto the Waitangi Treaty grounds. After the welcome, a church service will be held, including the blessing of the canoe Ngatoki Mata Whaurua, which will be paddled by 80 rowers to Whangaroa Harbour tomorrow for centennial celebrations. The French Minister of Defence is considering the possibility of decorating two Secret Service agents convicted in connection with the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior with the Legion of Honour. The British newspaper, The Independent, says the Defence Minister, André Giraud, made the suggestion in a written reply in the French Senate. Mr. Giraud said the question will be very carefully examined in the context of the rules governing the conduct expected of personnel on active service as soon as possible. The newspaper's correspondent in Paris believes that Alain Maffar and Dominique Prieur will be awarded the honour once enough time has passed for the facts of the case to be forgotten. In the first reported case of its kind since the recent student unrest in China, a university graduate has been sentenced to 7 years imprisonment for calling for the overthrow of the Communist Party. The man, Liu Tei, made a speech at a literary symposium in which he attacked the leadership's policies on economic reform and criticised the socialist system. Mr. Liu was also accused of taking advantage of the recent slackening of ideological controls by advocating capitalism in China. The weather forecast to midnight tonight over the North Island, fine except for isolated showers in the west this morning. In Nelson, Marlborough, Canterbury and Otago, fine. In the west from Bulleta to Fiordland, scattered showers. In Southland, showers becoming confined to the western high country and the coast this morning. For the Chatham Islands, a few showers. That's national and international news and weather to just after 8:05. And now here's Ron Mulligan with sports news.
The New Zealand women's golf team remained third going into the final round of the Queen Sirikit Cup tournament in Manila. Debbie Smith shot a par round of 73 and Brenda Ormsby 78, and the Kiwis are on 311, 13 shots behind tournament leaders Japan. Australia in second place on 305. Ormsby is fourth on the individual scoring list on 155, with Smith just one stroke behind her. On to cricket, and Central Districts chasing a win in the Shell Trophy Series were frustrated by Canterbury at New Plymouth yesterday. Central District's captain Martin Crowe wasn't happy that Canterbury batted all day on a perfect wicket to score just over 400.
To me, in a three-day game, that's a pretty hard thing to do because on a wicket that is going to be pretty good throughout, it completely shuts the other side out of the game. I mean, we're going to have to obviously have to declare behind, otherwise the game's going to fall into a horrible draw on the third day. It's always good to see both sides in with a chance. That's the way cricket should be played, especially when you're at the last game of the competition. And they got nothing to lose at all. And we've obviously got to try and get points if we have to. So he's batted all day, and it's up to him. But I feel that it's not really in the spirit of the game.
An unhappy Martin Crowe, but Canterbury skipper John Wright was philosophical about how the day went.
We don't have any hassles with the Central Districts. If they're disappointed we didn't declare, well, really, it's just one of those things. It's first-class cricket and decisions have to be accepted.
Meanwhile, Otago, contenders for the Shell Trophy along with Central Districts, are struggling at 20-4, chasing Auckland's 320-9. In the third game, Wellington against Northern Districts, no play yesterday because of rain. And the West Indies cricket selectors have made some surprise selections in their team to tour New Zealand shortly. Pam Corkery reports from Sydney that 2 days ago, the team manager said no player with the slightest hint of injury would be selected.
Then last night, manager Steve Camacho announced the surprise inclusion of pace bowler Michael Holding and opening batsman Gordon Greenidge. Greenidge hasn't played since the middle of January, and Holding broke down in his first game for a fortnight last Friday. Both have hamstring injuries. Equally surprising is the omission of spin bowler and star fielder Roger Harper, as well as that of all-rounder Winston Benjamin. Harper's spot will be filled by fellow Guyanese Clyde Butts, an off-spinner with three tests behind him. Another Guyanese, Carl Hooper, will replace Benjamin. For Radio New Zealand Sport, Pam Corkery in Sydney.
The West Indies' first game is a one-day match against Auckland, scheduled for Sunday week. And the West Indies captain, Viv Richards, wants a win over Australia in the World Series cricket match at Sydney tonight. The Windies have virtually no chance of qualifying for the finals, but Richards says it would be great to go out on a winning note and boost the team's confidence for the tour of New Zealand. The Australian Andrew Lloyd had to run a career-best time of 28 minutes of 4.39 seconds to beat New Zealand's Dave Burridge in the Australian 10,000-metre track championship at Melbourne last night. Burridge took the lead in the race with one lap to go, but Lloyd finished strongly over the last 250 metres to win by 2 seconds. Lloyd will now clash with Robert Di Castella in a $150,000 10-kilometre road race in Bali on Sunday. So Burridge's time to finish second was 28 minutes and 6 seconds in round figures. All the big names have made it through to post-section play in the Piers, which starts at the National Women's Bowls Championships in Christchurch today. Among those through are Anne Kedovich, Jean Ryan, Rhoda Ryan, Siswin Stanley and Merle Symes. And the Christchurch sprint cyclist Willie Rastrick has recovered sufficiently from his crash at Brisbane last weekend to ride at Launceston on Saturday in the second test between Australia and the rest of the world. Rastrick had 6 stitches removed from above his eye yesterday and says the doctor was pleased with the way his face had healed up. He rode at a Sydney club meeting last night and was pleased with his form, although he didn't extend himself. Meanwhile, Rastrick and Whanganui's Gary Anderson will lead the rest of the world team into the second test at Launceston with a 17-point lead over Australia. And that's the latest sports news. Don't forget the three Shell Cup cricket matches on today at the three venues around the country. Ron Mulligan, Radio New Zealand Sport.
It's 8:15 and you're listening to Good Morning New Zealand on National Radio on this Waitangi Day 1987. Our guests in the studio all morning have been Hari Williams and Bishop Manu Bennett, and they've been co-hosting the programme with me. We're joined now in the studio by Mr. Geoffrey Palmer, the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Justice. Good morning.
Hello.
And on the line from Auckland, Professor Keith Sorensen, Professor of History. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Over the next half hour or so, we're going to be looking at the Treaty of Waitangi, the legal status of things, and indeed something to do with how New Zealand celebrates the treaty. Now, Bishop, I wonder, over the last 5 years, there's been a great deal of acrimony over the complex issue of Waitangi. Do you think there's any one decision which could satisfy all of Māoridom, any one way of doing things?
No, I don't. I think it's an unfair expectation that most Pā has put upon us, that we should be of one opinion. I just want to say that I have no doubt at all about the fact that we're united on the Treaty of Waitangi, but we're not unanimous, which is quite a different thing.
What aspects are you united on?
That the treaty was originally a very good and noble document, that history knocked holes into it, and that it needs to be mended. We're not unanimous on the way it's to be mended.
Mr. Palmer, with the Bill of Rights, you are hoping to include the treaty in it. Is that a way of mending things, or is it a way of a new start?
I certainly have put it forward as a way of mending things. It is a very difficult concept, though, and one of the problems with incorporating the treaty into what some see as Pākehā law is that it disturbs and upsets its mana. And I wish that we could overcome that feeling, because I appreciate the feelings that the treaty sort of have a sacred aura about it. But the difficulty with that from the legal point of view is that if you're actually going to give it teeth and bite, it's necessary to have it capable of legal enforcement. And the history of the treaty in our courts has been a singularly unfortunate one. For the bulk of the 19th century, the courts in New Zealand said really that the treaty wasn't part of the law at all. And it's only in recent years that that attitude has started to change, and it started to change, I think, quite profoundly. We've had, of course, the Treaty of Waitangi Tribunal, which is set up now to hear grievances under the treaty, and the jurisdiction of that has now been extended back to 1840. That tribunal has done some very important and very good work, and I think it's enhanced the status and mana of the treaty greatly. I always remember the words of the tribunal in the Motunui report in 1983, which I'd just like to read. The treaty represents the gift by the Māori of the right to make laws in return for the promise to do so, so as to acknowledge and protect the interests of the indigenous inhabitants. That then was the exchange of gifts that the treaty represented, the gift of the right to make laws and the promise to do so as to accord the Māori interest an appropriate priority. I think that's a very good modern statement of what the treaty should mean in our legal system. Now, the problem we have in our legal system is to get the treaty into it in a way where courts can take it into account on an everyday basis. The Bill of Rights is an attempt to do that. I hope that it will be successful in that regard, but we've got a long way to go before we get to that.
Keith Sorensen, could I ask you to join in the discussion here? What's your view of where the treaty is today?
Well, whenever we talk about the treaty, we're really talking about two treaties, because the treaty was a document in two languages, English and Māori, and it's really had two histories. There's been a sort of Pākehā history of the treaty and a Māori history of the treaty. And whenever we look at that, we've got to look at those two histories. Whenever we look at what the treaty is today, we've got to look at those two sides of it, the Pākehā and the Māori.
Could you expand on what you mean by the two histories? What are the differences?
Well, they both stem from the two different language versions of the treaty. if you look at the English version, the way it has been regarded by Pākehās and by governments in New Zealand, they saw it as, in the first instance, the Māori ceding sovereignty to the British Crown. They saw it as an instrument by which British law was introduced into New Zealand, and Māoris were incorporated within that. They did see it as protecting Māori land, the possession of Māori land and other forest and fisheries and so on. And thirdly, of course, of according Māoris the rights and privileges of British subjects. But that has always been seen, or always until recently been seen, as a way of assimilating the Māoris into what is essentially a European civilization. But if you then turn over and look at the Māori side of the treaty, you see something that's very different, and Māoris have seen it as not merely a way of protecting their possessions, but the mana of their chiefs. Indeed, some Māoris have seen it as a way of preserving Māori sovereignty. And there has been a Māori history stemming from that Māori language version of the treaty. It's been frequently reiterated at Māori gatherings, and one hears it being reiterated again today. Māoris and many other people, of course, are now seeing the treaty not as a way of forming one people, but of forming a bicultural society. That stems from the two different versions of the treaty.
Well, now, Bishop, you were the chairman of the Hui at Ngaro Wahia, which sort of looked at this. We've already alluded to it in the programme. Perhaps you'd care to comment on what Professor Sarnson was saying.
The two versions, of course, have rather tended to contribute to the conflict. One would imagine, I think more than imagine, that the significant version of the treaty that was signed by the Māoris was the one in Māori. That's what they understood. That's what was presented to them. And it does differ in terminology from the Pāhā one. It has been said that nowhere in the Māori version did the word mana appear. They didn't cede that over. They ceded the right to govern, but not the right, not the mana or the power of sovereignty.
Geoffrey Palmer, how can you address this in the Bill of Rights?
I think that's one of the most difficult issues in the whole treaty, because there is this deep ambivalence. I think the historical traditions that Professor Sorensen's referred to reflect that as well. And there is quite a considerable argument as to what it's perhaps looked at best as whether or not the treaty was a document of political appropriation, or whether it wasn't. And I think the Pākehā view has tended to be that it was, and the Māori view has tended to be that it wasn't. All you can do in a document like this, if you're going to make it have legal force of the type which I'm suggesting, is put both versions in as they were, and leave that in the end to be determined by the arguments in the courts. I don't think that will actually harm the matter, because I think the Waitangi Tribunal has shown itself able to handle the ambiguities of it pretty well and come out with some very helpful modern applications of what the principles of the treaty mean today and now. And while it is true it's important to redress old grievances, it's the applications now, for example, in the Manukau Harbour case, which are of deep contemporary significance. Now, in the end, it's the spirit of the document that must pervade any interpretation of it. And I think, generally speaking, the spirit of it is pretty clear.
Look, we've now been joined in the studio by Rebecca Evans. Kia ora, Rebecca, welcome.
Kia ora.
Your attitude to the treaty, to the document at the moment, and the fact that we do have the two versions in the two languages, do you see it as one thing, or do you see them as two separate things?
Well, I see this whole question of the spirit of the document is probably the strongest aspect of it, probably one of the main reasons why it has, apart from the fact that it has never been ratified or recognised in legislation, the spirit of the document is probably the strongest force of the treaty today, and interpretation of what was intended at the time of the day is probably what the tribunal and a number of other Māori organisations have really been trying to grapple with or come to some sort of means of interpreting the intention of the document, despite the Minister of Justice's comments about what might happen if both versions were included in a potential Bill of Rights. I think that there is also an opinion within Māoridom about the fact that the inclusion of the treaty in the Bill of Rights might in fact compound the difficulties that already face the Waitangi Tribunal and the difficulties of interpretation at the moment. And it's no doubt a subject I think that needs to be pretty widely debated about what exactly is done with the treaty, whether its inclusion or left to stand alone. The weight of opinion at the Hui o Ngāru Wāhi has seemed to favour a standalone position for the treaty. Whether or not that means that the Bill of Rights includes all the other things that it's meant to include and leaves the treaty alone and we do something else with the treaty is a matter of public debate at the moment.
Things are going on, at Waitangi today and at Otiria Marae last night, and perhaps we'll just take a break from our discussion for a moment just to hear what Sir James Henare said on the Marae at Otiria last evening.
Regarding the spreading of the ceremonies to observe the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, last year, Sir James was quite adamant that the celebrations or the ceremonies should be held at Waitangi, but he somewhat modified his view.
The official function, of course, I understand, is still in the beehive. The function tomorrow is purely a Maori one, really, of Tai Tokerau. Taitokerau has always said that they will continue commemorating the day, and although the official function has been moved to Wellington, to the beehive, it is just a continuing thing as far as Taitokerau is concerned, and it is not the official function as such, although the Governor-General will be there as a guest of the Taitokerau people and the various ministers. But now Christchurch is having one. I think it's a good thing. I think the commemoration of the signing of the treaty, I think, should be a New Zealand affair and not just Waitangi or the Beehive or Christchurch. The more of our towns and villages and cities commemorate the signing of the treaty, I think the more important the treaty is to many, many people. I understand down in the South Island, for example, that many people there don't really know anything about Waitangi, so I think it's a good thing to spread these functions throughout the country. And it may be that this is the forerunner of other cities and towns also doing this, with Wellington and Christchurch.
As you know, I've been observing the Waitangi Day ceremonies here for more than 20 years, and something I do know is that the northern tribes of the Te Tokerau, for them the 6th of February will always have and has always had very special significance, and with this Sir James concurs.
I do agree. After all, the chiefs who signed the Treaty of Waitangi on the 6th of February are our own very ancestors from the five main tribes of Te Tokerau. So it's more than just the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. We feel we have a special affinity with those chiefs who signed the treaty and the Treaty of Waitangi. And we continue to commemorate that day because of the fact that they are our forebears. All of us are descended from them.
So despite the fact that the observances at Waitangi may not be so-called official, they still have that special...
It still has a special thing for us and special significance for us, because of those 40-odd chiefs who signed the treaty that day. And so it has continued and handed down to this day. And as the sole surviving member of the Runanga, Ongarangatira, the Treaty of Waitangi o Ngāpuhi, then this used to be done every year. But now all those old people are gone, and we, the younger folk, have just continued in a very small way.
Sir James Henare speaking at Ōtiria last night, and at Waitangi, I'm Henare Te Uau.